Peter Malone is my latest guest. My name is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Now, Peter Malone is a priest and film critic. He's based in Australia, and he was actually foundational when I was doing my PhD in the late 1990s. And with Peter, we talk about our shared interest in Christ-figure films, including the distinction between redeemer figures and saviour figures, as well as Peter's work on antichrist figures. Peter speaks about how these films reveal one's own understanding of Jesus himself. And we talk about the evolution of Jesus films. Now, Peter has been reviewing films since 1968, and he has a drive to see every film. He relays how he was once asked, "Why can't you just watch a film?" We learn about how Peter goes about reviewing a film. We learn that he spent 11 years in London. He became part of the London Film Critic Circle. And he asks me if I pay to see any of the many films that I go and watch. Now, Peter often writes discussion questions relating to each film. We learn why he once wrote a letter to each of the films that have influenced him. In the 90s, he visited Pacific countries like the Solomon Islands, which have given him a wider horizon about how people appreciate films in different countries. He tells us what he thinks about the booing and hissing that often goes on at Cannes. And we talk about whether the role of the audience impacts on the way he reviews a film. He talks about meeting Martin Scorsese. I ask Peter if studios pay attention to the reviews of critics like himself. We talk about the Marvel canon of films. We learn that in the 1990s, Peter interviewed as many Australian directors as he was able to. He tells us why directors are more interesting to have conversations with than actors. We find out about how his views on All That Jazz changed on the second viewing, and why an English patient kind of left him cold. We learn why, when people ask him if he is sick of watching films all the time, his answer is not yet. It was an immense privilege for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews to meet Father Peter Malone. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is such a pleasure this week to catch up with Peter Malone, who's in Australia. And Peter, we were just saying before we started recording that I came across your work quite a few decades ago now, when you were a real pioneer. Well, you are a pioneer in the field of theology and film.
Well, thanks for that. I suppose as I look back on many decades, I'd better tell you. Yes, I'll tell you a story to start off with on theology and film. I used to be very keen back in the 60s and 70s on Christ figures. And I remember that Clint Eastwood started to make Christ figure films in the first half of the 1970s. High Plains Drifter, when he was a kind of devil savior figure, whipping people and setting the town alight, but saving all the poor and cripples. But then he did Outlaw Josie Wales, one of my favourite films. And the first couple of minutes is Outlaw Josie Wales one of your films, Chris?
It absolutely is. It took me a few occasions to really appreciate it, but the texture in it, I think, is phenomenal.
Well, those first 3 minutes after the Civil War and the raiders come in and kill his wife and son, and he drags the bodies to bury them, and he says, "Ashes to ashes, dust to dust." Actually, some of them find it very difficult to understand his accent when he says that. But the Lord he gives, the Lord he takes away. And he's made a cross and it falls on his shoulder. Now, I'd have to tell you, to my amazement, in the mid-70s, I could show that film and nobody made the Christ connection. So it became something of a mission, I suppose. So that especially during the 80s and writing on Christ figures and doing seminars, that became, I suppose, very important for me. So, yes, it's been significant. And I suppose that sets me back to, in fact, the late 60s when I started to teach theology and into the 70s and onwards.
And I always find with this whole area of Christ figures, because obviously it's an area that's very close to my teaching and research as well, but I was always trying to make sure that it didn't become too much of a join the dots exercise, because I was conscious that sometimes I'd be watching a film and, you know, people would be coming up to me afterwards and said, oh, which of these characters is the Christ figure? And I'd think, there's something wrong with this. And I thought, you know, I don't know whether it's important if the filmmaker intended it. Obviously, an audience will interpret a film in whatever way they that they deem fit. But did you find that there was a clear attempt? Because I know Adele Reinhardt, who I've also interviewed, is very, you know, big on this territory as well. Did you sort of get the sense that the filmmakers were aware of this? Were they doing it consciously, or were they doing it in some way, perhaps just to provoke the audience?
Yes, I'm not sure that there were too many actually intending Christ figures. The story is Melissa Matheson, who wrote the script for E.T., going to the studio, thought she'd written a kind of Peter Pan story for Spielberg, and then she said, then I noticed the Christ resemblances. So she had a Catholic background and obviously drew on those, but not so consciously and intentionally. And I always like to say to people in a seminar, not everyone whose name is Jesus, well, not every mafia who signs the cross before he gets shot is actually a Christ figure. It has to be significant and substantial. And I think that that's important, yes.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, because what I was finding is that this whole, you know, the whole canon really of films like Cool Hand Luke or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where you're dealing with non-conformist figures. And I think that was the challenge. And that's actually what really galvanised me when I was doing the PhD as well. Because a lot of people were sometimes thinking that, oh, well, if a character is like Christ, then it must be a very, you know, very kind and considerate and, you know, very sort of optimistic kind of person. And I thought, well, yeah, but when you start breaking it down, you know, you sort of can see that once the floodgates are going to open pretty swiftly, if you don't have some clear sort of parameters in place. And I think that what it then did was make me rethink both what the film was all about, but also about the category of Christ as well. So I kind of felt that it was that watching these films was reshaping and reframing my theology, as well as enabling me to watch films through a completely different lens.
Yes, I was impressed. I think this is now again back in the 80s or so, with the Anglican theologian F.W. Dillaston, who made the distinction between Redeemer figures and Saviour figures. And when I did that book, Movie Christ and Antichrist, in the 80s, it was the time of liberation theology. And then out came the mission. And so you could see the suffering figures. You could see the saving resurrection kind of figures. And then that introduced the liberation whole movement, salvation through that, even starting with Moses, I suppose, and going right through. But as the years went on, and I don't know whether you've come across a book I did, Screen Jesus, about 2012, published in America, gave me the chance to go through all the Jesus films, but also gave me a chance to have some chapters on the Christ figures and realize, you know, you can have clown figures. So Jesus the clown, etc. The interesting thing with that book was we started to work on the Antichrist figures as well. So you've got that kind of contrast of goodness and evil. So, yes, that's certainly been a focus.
Yeah. And do you find, as I did, that students would sometimes say, you know, thank you. In my case, they'd say, thank you, Chris, for introducing me to all of this. But then they said that they can never go to the cinema again without reflecting, perhaps to an unhealthy degree, on some of the things we've looked at in class. So they said, I used to think that going to the cinema was great escapism on a Friday night. It was something I did with my friends. Now all I'm doing is going away and looking for the theological parallels. And I said, well, I'm not necessarily encouraging you to do that, but I think it's good to be aware of some of the different lenses that are there, and it's for you to decide, you know, how you intersect with those. But you must have had that same experience of particularly when you were doing this in the 70s and 80s, when it wasn't really being done elsewhere. You were, in that sense, a trailblazer. Did you find that students were coming up to you, and maybe still are coming up to you, and saying that actually what you have done is very much transformed the way that they engage with the medium of film?
Yes, they have. Somebody said, not thank you, but the opposite, because they were doomed then to be looking at films in that way. What I found is, depending on the audience for the workshops, so you're dealing with students opening up vistas. I often was dealing with older people, say clergy and sisters, who were doing renewal programs. And I must say, some of those were the best people to work with, that whatever their background, it still didn't have the visuate aspect of it. And that's what they were discovering. And not only did they start to recognize, they were able to articulate the reasons for why they recognized these characteristics. And in that sense, and I always like to point out to people, it actually reveals your own understanding of Jesus himself. And that is a revelation as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, because this is what I was finding, is that some people would be assessing the biblical epics or the Jesus films in a way that coincided with their particular denominational or faith background. And so what I think was quite funny is how a few years ago, literally, I think it was about 2018, I was teaching a course on religion and film with my undergraduates here at Kent. And I asked them, you know, who has seen any of the Jesus films that we're about to look at? So, you know, the classics like King of Kings and Greatest Story Ever Told, even Last Temptation. And they hadn't seen any of them. Maybe a few had seen Monty Python's Life of Brian. But I thought, well, this is going to be a real struggle, because they're going to sit through for 2 hours me talking about films that they have no interest in seeing. But then I said, okay, who has seen Bohemian Rhapsody? Because that, and they were like, oh, we saw that last night. Or, you know, why is our lecturer talking about, you know, a film about Freddie Mercury? And then on the spot, I found myself engaging with that film in the light of all the discourse on Jesus figures, in terms of, you know, somebody who perhaps after his death has been put on a pedestal, or somebody who was, you know, quite a non-conformist figure in many ways, somebody who was quite an anti-establishment figure, and somebody who rocked the boat, rocked the stage. And we were looking at all of this and the issue of biopics and hagiography. And suddenly I found that, because I was not reading my script, but I was reflecting on a film that I myself had just seen a few nights earlier, because that was in my mind and it was new to the students as well, that made us rethink what Bohemian Rhapsody, which most of, in the room had seen, but also the Jesus films. And it was one of those sort of moments that you couldn't repeat, in the sense that it wouldn't, if I was delivering that lecture now, it wouldn't feel right to draw on that film, because it wasn't fresh in my mind and it would feel a bit sort of artificial. But that was one of the great pleasures of doing this sort of work, because if you got a hook, and even if it's, you know, not what you're looking at, even if you're talking about Christ figures in a film that the students haven't seen, they can apply the tenets that you're looking at to other contexts.
Actually, back on the Jesus films, Chris, I'm about to do two workshops, one that I like very much, to enable people to come to terms with the Jesus films. And it's to take the scenes of the adulteress from John chapter 8, start with intolerance, show the clip from there, then DeMille, then the 1961 King of Kings, Greatest Story Ever Told, moving then to Zeffirelli, moving to The Last Temptation, to Roger Young's Jesus of 1999, and then the Gospel of John, 2003, The Passion of the Christ with the flashback to Mary Magdalene, and then Son of Man. Now, you can do that if you've got the clips ready within a short amount of time. And it enables me to say, look at the piety and look at the theology of 2016 for intolerance. What was happening by the 20s, when my father would have been going to see King of Kings? Then that huge gap, which I don't understand why Jesus wasn't as such on screen, except bits in the robe or Ben-Hur, till 61. And then it's only 60 years ago that you first heard Jesus speak in a mainstream film, see him in colour, and then what happened during the 60s and onwards into our own time. And it's really an eye-opener. And you simply ask the question, does this Jesus appeal to you or not? Why? And you get all kinds of antagonism towards Max von Sydow, for instance. He's too stern. Yeah. But Jeremy Sisto in 1999 gets a lot of oohs and ahs, very popular. So I've found that I need to do that even before I do the Christ figure material. And there was a book published recently, a big one. I can't remember the name of it now, but we were asked, a whole lot of people, I don't know whether you were in it, chapters on Jesus and film. So I did an article describing my experience of showing those scenes. But I would say it's an easy way in if you've got the clips and it works very well. And then you've got openness to Christ figures as well.
No, and that is such a good approach. And actually, you're right. I remember not too many years ago, maybe 12, 13 years ago now, when we were still just about using VHS, I was coming into the class with the films on different cassettes, and I'd set them in the right place so I could show them, and it was just disastrous sometimes, and the technology never seemed to work. And then, of course, YouTube can actually give us stuff on the spot. But what I was finding is that I'd be looking at all of these films with the students, but they would do exactly what you just said. They'd look at Max von Sydow in The Greatest Story Ever Told and say he's very detached, he's not very likable. That's not how they see Jesus. I remember one student in particular saying that she came from an evangelical background and that Jesus that we saw in that film just did not connect at all. But then I would show an image of Max von Sydow in a film like the Spielberg film, that Minority Report, that they had seen, and they were like, oh, that's the same actor, oh, we really liked him in that, or, you know, so in a funny way, that was a good way into the films. Or of course, the classic Willem Dafoe, who was in the Spider-Man films, and I think that was often a good way. So they were looking at his representation of Jesus from a different sort of entry point. And I find that helped, although there's always the one student who'll tentatively put up the hand and say, what about Body of Evidence with Madonna?
Oh.
Maybe we shouldn't talk about that one, or Speed 2, Cruise Control. But the opportunities are endless in terms of the way in. And I think what you have just outlined is so spot on, because rather than turn up to a class and say, now we're going to look at these films that you're not interested in and never heard of, you're taking the students a different way in by perhaps giving them the chance to compare and contrast, and maybe then let them find their particular way into this discourse. And then they might voluntarily say, on the basis of that, I'm going to choose to watch this film tonight. And I've had a few students come up to me in that regard. They've, you know, you've given them 10 options and they say, actually, okay, you've convinced me to at least give it a go.
One thing about Max von Sydow, the screenwriter, I don't know whether you remember, but he's handling the stone and then he suddenly thrusts it to the ground and Carol Baker shudders. And I point out to them, whoever is innocent cast the first stone, that was Jesus, but not at the woman. And they say, oh, that's an idea. So there's all kinds of the creativity of the writers and directors in each of those episodes is, I think, can be very creative, yes. In fact, in DeMille's, Jesus writes in Hebrew letters on the sand. I haven't seen him do that in any other film.
And so, obviously, you still go to the movies. You're still a big film watcher. And do you feel that, you know, whereas a few years ago, perhaps you were writing in an area that wasn't, and we didn't have the internet in those days, so it wasn't as though there was, you know, a great deal of material out there. You were, in many cases, were framing this. How do you feel things have changed now in terms of the the way that a lot of this material is now so prolific? It's so easy to access online, and there's all these sort of publications. Do you kind of feel that you have the same sort of apprehension of films today as you did 30, 40 years ago?
No, I must say, I like to say this is my 54th continuous year of reviewing. Yeah. I started in 1968 with To Sir With Love, which doesn't seem to me so long ago, but that was and Far From the Madding Crowd, they were the first two. But a friend of mine, Alan Frank, who used to review for the Daily Star, retired now, he said, the trouble with you is you're a completist. And he's not wrong, that somehow or other I have this drive to see everything possible. And I do see a lot of material, perhaps like you mentioned with Escape Room that you saw recently. I can think about all kinds of things while I'm watching something which is not particularly worthwhile. But you have, of course, with Netflix And with your recording, you've got the fast forward. So that in itself, in the cinema, no, but at home, you can actually edit for yourself and use the fast forward, pause, have a look again, all those kinds of things. I find with watching the films, I'll say this. People asked me how I'd describe myself, and I'd say, not as a critic, that if I write, say, for a book, a chapter of a book, then I'm using my critical sense and judgments. Whereas I say a reviewer mediates the film from the reviewer to the audience. And so it's not a matter of doing a lot of judging. It's rather interpreting how an audience might like, not like, or perhaps respond to a film. So it's finding language. So if I say, I don't like to say crude language, but use something like raucous, those kinds of things, which a lot of people tell me they don't find a film as objectionable as I might. So I'm trying to take that into account and suggest frank dialogue or this kind of alert without making the judgment. Sometimes I do say that a lot of swearing seems to be the lack of ability to be creatively expressive. So that's another question. So in my approach to films, it hasn't changed in the sense that, right, here's the film at the moment, whether it be 1973, 1994, 2021, I'm looking at them, see how it affects me. And I can give you all kinds of Jungian reasons, but I tend not just to see the film as it's there on the screen, not very sensing in that sense, but the intuitive function, everything is interesting. The characters, how does that connect with that performance? The writers, the story, the themes. And somebody said, why can't you just go and watch a film?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I said, that's how I do watch a film. And it'll be different from the person who says, wasn't the scenery glorious? I loved the colour and the costumes and the musical score, which unfortunately I often tend not to hear. They will talk in that way. So that has sustained me all these decades, but it's very much the work of a reviewer.
And do you find that when you go to the cinema, and I don't know whether you go to the same cinema each time or a multiplex or a more independent cinema, but I always find that they must see me as a bit of an enigma because I go on my own and I go every evening. I mean, literally, I go from work to the cinema. And I often think that although I'm very transparent in what I do with my students and I have a social media presence, it is kind of interesting because there's a level of commitment there, which you have also been doing for decades. So what's your sort of protocol here? Do you plan your schedule like a week in advance, and then do you the people at the cinema that you go to, are they aware of the reviews that you write?
No, nobody's aware, except we have a lot of press previews, which are diminished, by the way, at the moment, especially with Sydney in lockdown. So we've got a group, and I've been going to those for best part of 50 years. So you know, a lot of the mainstream reviewers tend to be a bit aloof as regards us who are on the kind of community radio, ordinary, on those levels. But there's a kind of camaraderie. I should mention that, I don't know whether you're aware, but I spent 11 years in London from 1999 to 2010. I had a job with the Catholic cinema organisation, OSIC, and then when it combined with radio and television to Cygnus. So I was living there in Hammersmith and became part of the London Film Critics Circle. They admitted me to that. And the interesting thing, they met me when I went to the first preview as Peter Malone, that Australian Catholic, he's a priest. And I realised that if I'd gone as Father Peter Malone, I don't know that there were any other Catholic reviewers. But Alexander Walker, who'd had a criticism of me in cinema in Sight and Sound once upon a time, I introduced myself, and ever afterwards I was Father Malone, always. But I found, again, generally the ordinary reviewers very friendly, so that you could discuss. Philip French, I thought, was one of the best reviewers and one of the most friendly, amiable, walked with a limp, and I would walk with him from preview to preview. So in a sense, that's my background of reviewing, is the feedback comes from the second tier, so to speak, generally, of reviewers with whom we compare notes. So otherwise, if I haven't seen the film at a preview, I have 26 cinemas in three multiplexes within 40 minutes walking of home. So I've got plenty of opportunity. And this is a terrible thing to say, but I should ask you, do you actually pay to see a film?
I do. What I actually do is have a subscription to two different chains. One of them is called Cineworld, the other is Curzon. And I pay, it only works out about £18 a month, which is nothing. Because if I paid to see a film in London, if I was in Hammersmith, I'd probably be paying close to £18 for a single film on its own terms. So the way my logic is that the more often I go, the more money I save. Apart from petrol costs, then I obviously will pay for maybe not every night popcorn, but I'll have always a latte with my drink. But I do pay for it. And in that sense, there's a certain independence, because I think, and this is something we can perhaps move on to, but I was very conscious when I was doing my PhD that people, and it was probably in my head, but I was conscious that people might think, oh, he's watching films, he's doing a PhD. So it was almost a sense of which I needed not to try and say, oh, I need to be reimbursed for going to see that film, because who's to say that any sort of nonsense I might go and watch is going to end up in the thesis. So I kind of wanted to be able to do things on my terms and then decide the parameters of what should be included, what not included. So I wasn't having to justify my decisions. And there's a bit of hypocrisy perhaps on my part, because in my PhD I was very keen to say, you know, let's look at film noir, let's look at the films of Scorsese, and I was making this distinction between, you know, redemptive films and escapist films, but in truth I'll go to the multiplex like everybody else and I'll watch some of the same films as everyone else and often enjoy them. So it's not as though I'm particular about the films I see. I don't watch as many non-English language films as I'd like to. I do whenever I get the chance, but that's not always what's on offer at the multiplex. So in that sense, there are limitations to what I do. But let me turn that question around. Do you pay to watch a film at the cinema?
Generally not. No, I did have the Cineworld card when I was in London. But no, we've been very blessed in Australia. We have film critics associations, and a lot of the distributors are very generous. Public holidays and Saturday evenings not, but by and large, the big chains, Village Roadshow, and generally most of the smaller companies, the independent ones, actually accept our cards. So we're very lucky in that way. It means then that I can see so much. That unlike yourself, when you have to budget, I have access really to all those films generally whenever I want. So, as I say, we've been very, very blessed. And here in Melbourne, we have so many art house cinemas and so many art house distributors, so that, again, a lot of them can't afford the press previews, so they will send Vimeo links. So, in fact, tonight I have a Vimeo link to watch a documentary about a home for the elderly in the US called Some Kind of a Hero. Never heard of it before, but they've sent it actually today. So the distributors and the publicists in Australia are very supportive of the reviewers, giving them the opportunity. And by and large, they know us, they know how we write, they know what we like. And of course, truth told, a lot of the publicists like a number of the films much less than we do. Yeah. So as I say, it's been a very interesting long experience of reviewing, and I'd have to praise the distributors, exhibitors, and the publicists that have supported us over the years.
Yeah. And do you write your reviews immediately afterwards, or do you give it a day or two? Do you have a particular sort of routine or schedule for enabling the chance to reflect on the film? And perhaps, as you say, talk to other reviewers. Maybe, I don't know if you read other reviews before you write your own, but, you know, what's the kind of approach that you take to watch and then review?
I leave some time. I have the great fortune, you asked about planning. I feel it's bad if I go out and I don't see two films. What a waste of a trip. So it's that kind of thing. And I find I'm able to retain the memory of the film, even if I see something immediately afterwards. I don't get the opportunity to write a review generally till the next day. But, well, you've seen some of the ones that I thought I'd send you some. Since about 2013, I speak them all onto Dragon Speech Registration. So I don't literally write them. And I found that I enjoy spontaneously talking. So a review might take only 5 minutes, in a sense, for a 500-word review. So I've got out the spontaneous response, some smart phrases that I might have thought of during the film, those kinds of things, though I don't like to put the film down as such by smart remarks. And then you have the luxury of going over them and editing them as you like. But I don't know that I could go back to literally sitting at the computer and writing a review anymore.
Yeah, and it is interesting how I find this. It was almost a bit of a game, I suppose. On Facebook once, I said that I was at the cinema, and a friend of mine also was used to write reviews afterwards. And then what was happening is the people were saying to me, "Oh, I'm glad you've gone to see whatever the film was. I'm looking forward to your review." And of course, then that actually kind of helped, because it made me think, people are waiting for this review, because I started doing this. And I realized that, you know, although Facebook may not, you know, it can be a bit transient, I make sure I don't post them and then lose them. But that got me in the habit of coming back from the cinema and spending 20 minutes, half an hour writing what I thought. But then I found that sometimes this was getting a bit crazy, because I might be teaching at 9 o'clock the next morning. And I thought, you know, why am I, you know, I don't have to do this. No one is making me do this. So what I then did, and certainly during lockdown, is that I might watch a film, but then simply post that I'd watched it a couple of days later. And then that would just give me time to post a review when I had a bit more time. But there's a clear structure. I'm also a diary writer. So there's always a sort of sense of compartmentalizing what you do. And actually the film reviews are kind of similar to writing a diary, because it's a way of encapsulating something that you're doing, concretizing it. And, you know, and you can never stop. You can't think, oh, I won't bother with this review, or, you know, if I've got time, I'll do it. If not, you know, if you see the film, the review comes with it. It's in the same way you couldn't say to your students, you know, I want you to submit an essay by next Thursday, and then not mark it. If you set the essay, you have to mark it. If I see the film, I have to review it. If I don't want to review a film, I wouldn't go and watch it. So in that sense, it's like with the nostalgia interviews, as we were saying just before we started, it's not difficult then to suddenly amount to hundreds. I don't know how many I've written altogether. Obviously, considerably fewer than you have done, but certainly I'm guessing I probably have done somewhere in the region of about 1,000 so far.
The thing is, Chris, I also have a website, because from 1969, I was influenced very much by Americans of all denominations. In fact, they got enthusiastic about film and theological reflection, and a lot of them started to write questions about films. So since 69, and the film Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, which was the first, I've actually written for most films discussion questions. So those I try to do as immediately after the film. In fact, sometimes I do the questions and then, having articulated that, write the review, because I've given some thought in the questions. So they're all on a website. I don't know how many thousands there are, but as I say, from 1969. And I find then I've got various people that I send the reviews to around the world and around Australia, and I get some feedback from those people as well. But the resource there on the website, a lot of people, you know, teachers say, oh, I wonder what he thought of that film, or what's a lead for that. Now, another thing, while I think of it, this is for your future book. Last year, during COVID, unfortunately, so no book launch, a book was published which I called Dear Movies. And it's letters to 101 favourite films, because anybody can write 100, so I thought I'll do 101. But I was listening to the radio, and an American librarian said that she had to throw out a lot of books because they were out of date or falling apart. But she wrote to some of the books that she valued. And I thought, that's it. So by the time I got home after listening to this in the car, I decided that I would write a letter to these key films that influenced me, under 1,000 words per letter. And so it finished up, again, an interesting experience, what I would choose, and important films which didn't have that kind of influence. So it's kind of diary in retrospect. So I'd say, if that's a good idea, keep the diary in mind, because something like Dear Movies, which I called it, is a creative kind of idea and an outlet as well.
Yeah, and that's wonderful advice, because one thing that I do in my diary is obviously say, you know, where I've been and what I've done. But I didn't used to, until I started doing these reviews 3-4 years ago, I didn't have a record. So what would happen is that my diaries are full of references to saw so-and-so, and I might just, you know, I didn't used to write that much in those days, so I might simply say whether I like the film or not. But I'd have this memory of a film which was not always corroborated by what was written in the diary. So there are a couple of films. Frequency is one that comes to mind. You know, the film about the two-way radio between the father and son in the 60s and the late 60s and late 90s. And I think it's a tremendous film. But when I, and I always said to people, oh, I saw it in 2000 and I thought it was excellent. I looked at my diary a few years ago and I just wrote it. And I thought, you know, I didn't think it was all that special. I thought, but I have this memory of really liking this film. So what I now do is like I suppose in a way it's like a letter to myself or to my future self or whoever wants to read this in the future. So I do have a record of everything I think about a film at the time that I see it. But then I'm very intrigued. Roger Ebert would always do the same thing. You know, he'd go back on films he'd watched 30 years earlier and write a completely fresh review. I find that intriguing because I'm interested in the whole context of watching the film, where I was in my life. Was I doing my PhD? Was I, you know, what sort of facilities did I have? Did I have access to a good set of cinemas? And that often would, of course, influence what I was able to watch. But the context around watching it, I think, is really important. And so often when I write my reviews, I might say, I saw Independence Day at the cinema not far from me here in East Kent a few days ago. And I remember going to see it in Aberystwyth in West Wales back in 1996. That was a very long time ago. So in that sense, I'm able to sort of draw the threads. But I just wish I'd had a review from those days. That's one of my biggest regrets.
One of the things I did want to say, you looked a bit surprised as we look on Zoom in this discussion, that I had been in London.
Yeah.
For those years.
Yeah, I wish we'd caught up.
Well, now, the reason I was there is because of the International Catholic Film Organizations, and I headed them up in the Pacific during the 1990s and then got elected to be the world head of it in 98, and we were going to merge with radio and television. So I said to my superiors here, I think I need to be in Europe, need to be in London to be present for all the discussions for the merger, which happened. And in 2001, we all combined and we chose the word Cygnus, which didn't have any specific meaning, signs and fire, S-I-G-N-I-S, and it became the World Catholic Association for Communication. And I got elected the head of that. So I stayed on for a couple of years afterwards for our cinema desk. So that was the reason for being in London. The headquarters are actually in Brussels, but for sanity and language's sake, it seemed to be better to be in London. And then the reviews, the London film critics, the opportunities, Cineworld pass, all those kinds of things. But what I wanted to say, Chris, that has enhanced me is that world experience. So that during the 1990s, I went to so many of the Pacific countries, which otherwise I'd never would have visited. So we were having seminars in New Caledonia and in Tonga and in Fiji. We're up in the Cook Islands, Solomon Islands, wonderful experiences, which gave me, I suppose, I hope, a wider horizon and how people appreciated films in different countries and also local industries. So that when I had the 11 years or so in England, I was in and out of London twice a month, traveling to all kinds of different countries, meeting different people. And we had juries, Catholic juries, and we also had ecumenical juries at Cannes, at Berlin, etc. So going there. And also we had interfaith juries, that the Iranians came to the Vatican in 2001 in a delegation. They invited the Catholics to Fajj in Tehran. I found I was sent there in 2002 and then went for a number of years to Iran. And I went there first when it was George Bush said it was part of the axis of evil. And it didn't seem quite that way to a visitor, not condoning anything there. But I found a lot of Iranians dreaded the thought and were frightened of the United States if ever they went there. So you learn a whole lot of cultural things. And I suppose I'm very appreciative of having had that long experience internationally. Now, I should mention, you did an interview with Gay Ortiz. In fact, Gay was my vice president in my final years of the International Catholic Office, and she was also vice president, one of the vice presidents at the beginning of Cygnus. So I looked at your interview with her with great interest. So I had known her, you know, over all those years and her contribution to that work as well.
Yeah, no, Gay was a huge influence. And actually, we worked together. I've worked both with Clive Marsh and with Gay Ortiz separately. But obviously, that explorations in theology and film book that came out actually during my PhD. And I just remember, even to this day, I can remember one morning sitting in an office in West Wales and seeing your piece on Edward Scissorhands, and having done a lot of work on Christology as an undergraduate, suddenly I thought, this is it. This means that I can do the PhD. You know how sometimes people might say, oh, I was going to do my PhD in this, and then something else came out, and I realized that they've stolen my thunder. I've never seen it that way. I've always thought, when somebody writes in an area, that validates it. The question is, what's your take? How do you use that? How do you appropriate it? What direction do you take it in? So for me, that was the biggest endorsement I could get, to have a collection of essays that helped me think through and reframe all of this discourse. But the context, something else I was going to ask you, actually, you mentioned all the different countries that you've been to, but do you find that the audience that you're with, who may not always necessarily be a group of critics, film critics, do you find that they have a bearing on the way that you apprehend the film? And does that feature in your reviews?
I'd like to think not. Certainly, if you go to festivals, you sit with the oddest audiences in their reaction, and booing and hissing at Cannes, I think is stupid, really. I think it's just exhibitionism on some of the part. Although, say, I'm just thinking, I went to Ukraine once, which was an interesting experience. And the kind of responses, I wasn't on the wavelength, I don't think, of the way people were responding. But I'd hoped that I could concentrate, you know, on the film itself. But you're right, it is interesting. People laughing at the wrong times, all that kind of thing. People walking out and making a drama of walking out. A quick story. Here in Melbourne, we had the preview of Bruce Beresford's Black Robe about the Canadian missionaries. And we would read in the Lives of the Saints about the tortures by the Native Americans, you know, pulling out fingernails. Well, there was a brief scene in the film of the pulling of a fingernail, and one lady stood up, almost screamed and walked out, "I can't take this." All this kind of, these things happen. A bad thing, by the way, in the London reviewers, a lot of them sat in the back row and laughed badly. I always found that the reviewers I admired sat in the front rows and responded to the film. So that was that's just a comment on what you asked. But I do want to say one thing, if I might, talking about Gay Ortiz in your interview. I looked at your interview with Rose Packard, and she mentioned me, so I'm doing her the courtesy of mentioning her. But the friendship I had with Rose and the Daughters of St. Paul and our project Lights, Camera, Faith, where I chose a film for every Sunday of the year, major feast day in the liturgical calendar, and wrote commentaries, and Rose then collaborating with that. I wanted to call it a movie lectionary. They actually did put that on the cover, but the Americans said, "Lights, Camera, Faith." Yeah. So we had those books. So it's been that's been a very interesting kind of collaboration in terms of the world of Catholic media. And we couldn't this year because of COVID, but every 4 years, Cygnus has a World Congress. The last one was in Quebec in 2017, and we all met, and it was a wonderful experience. By the way, our guest at that Congress was Martin Scorsese, and an acknowledgement of silence and his career. And I must say, he was a model of courtesy. He spoke very well. He was at the dinner, came to the Mass, really participating in the whole thing. Sadly, no Congress in 2021.
And you must have met some amazing figures, but you've just outlined two of them who are very influential to me. But do you find that the filmmakers sometimes read your reviews, or do they avoid reviews? Do the reviews sometimes have a bearing on the kind of films that they go on to make? You know, I suppose maybe not directly, but studios are going to be perhaps more conscious of what audiences are doing. If audiences are paying money to see a film, well, that's going to have a bearing perhaps on whether there might be a sequel, but there is surely going to be some sense in which you put something pen to paper, and that's going to be picked up on by filmmakers, and in that sense you're holding them to account to some extent through your reviews, but it can presumably also work both ways.
Yes, I'm not sure that filmmakers read too many of the second tier level, so to speak, reviews, but I had a wonderful experience during the 1990s. I decided to interview as many Australian directors as I could. Haven't interviewed many international directors unless they were visiting Australia. But I must say, talking with the Australian directors, and by the way, all the interviews are actually on my website, so they were preserved. So ranging from Fred Skepsey, Bruce Beresford, George Miller. George Miller was funny. He was so dismayed with the failure of Babe Pig in the City that for 6 months you weren't allowed to talk to him, but eventually. But I found the directors far more interesting to have conversations with than the actors. And the other interesting thing, I suppose, in connection with what you were asking, a number of the directors would say thank you at the end of the interview because I hadn't asked them about the budget, how they got on with their stars, all those kinds of things. But they were able, I hope, enable them to talk about the films and what they meant to them as they made them and thought about them. So I'm all for directors, a bit hesitant about movie stars.
Yeah. And And also, of course, it can be counterproductive to meet your heroes, as they say. I've never had the privilege to meet Martin Scorsese. I did meet Thelma Schoonmaker once, and I was so nervous that I asked her a question. It was a Q&A afterwards, and I thought I better ask a very clever question because, you know, I've come all this way, and it really backfired, and I regret that because other people were asking questions like, "Oh, is there too much violence in Scorsese's films?" And I was like, I would never have asked something like that. But actually, that was kind of that fitted the mood of the room rather than asking about, you know, particular types of editing style or whatever. But back to something we were just saying, actually, about what happened at Cannes, people walking out. Yeah, that from the ecumenical juries I've been at, then I've been at screenings where people, and you know that they're going to walk out in advance because you hear this rumour. But you would never do that. I've seen the same films then at the multiplex. And of course, people are paying their money to see a film. I suppose it's a bit different there because they're going to see a film because it's a genre that they like and they're paying their money. Whereas at a film festival, there's a sense in which you feel a compulsion to watch something and you wouldn't necessarily have chosen to see it. But when I saw Jojo Rabbit just over a year ago, before the first lockdown, I saw it twice. I was only going to see it once. I didn't like it at all. There were people laughing around me, lots of young boys who were laughing at what I thought was, you know, obviously the film's dealing with anti-Semitism. And I just thought, this isn't funny. I didn't like the audience I was with. But lots of people said, give it another go. And I thought, well, you know, anyway, I saw it at a completely different cinema. Coincidentally, I ended up sitting next to one of my colleagues at work. He was there with his family. Completely different experience. And I found it a very moving film. So that's what has taught me a lesson, that even if I'm not aware that I'm doing it, when I'm reviewing a film, I'm kind of also writing a review of the context in which it's being watched, because I don't think I did write a second review of Jojo Rabbit, or maybe I augmented my original review. But is that something that you're conscious of, that a film, two different occasions has made you perhaps even revisit it and write another review of it because you've had such a different reaction to it second time around?
There's a couple of films that come to mind in the past. It's not the audience. The films had, say, very good reputation, and I couldn't relate to them. And so I actually went again. Two of them, I changed my mind completely. One was All That Jazz. I don't know why it put me off the first time. I went again, and I thought it was marvelous. And it's one of my dear movies, as it turns out. At a festival, I think I was tired, and that's another factor. And I saw a Portrait of a Lady with Nicole Kidman, and it didn't do anything for me. And I went back again, and I changed. Now, this is a strange experience, but The English Patient didn't do anything for me. So I thought I'd better go again, and it didn't do anything for me. And that afternoon, I had to interview Saul Zaintz, the producer. So I was very, very discreet and objective. And I still don't know why The English Patient didn't do it for me. But I think that those are the kinds of things that happen. And it's a matter of sensibilities. I don't think everybody has to like everything. And I think that's an important, certainly in seminars, everybody has different tastes and different interests, different styles. I mightn't like Chinese, but I might like Italian, and nobody condemns me for those choices. So I think in terms of listening to people responding to films, it's a lot to do with sensibilities, as well as audiences, how well you felt, how tired you were, all those kinds of things. I heard one reviewer at Death Trap. I was sitting, and he was notoriously anti most films. And he announced to the person next to him, he'd just been to the dentist. And I thought, that's the end of Death Trap for him.
Yeah, yeah. And it is interesting, isn't it? Because I don't find those, the Marvel films, they don't connect with me at all. And it's intriguing because they're the films that if I put a review out, people will read the review and they'll say, oh, but, you know, you haven't seen all the other ones. And I was like, I may have seen them, I may not have seen them, I may not have seen them in the right order, but I just can't bring myself to care. And I wonder if it's part of it that I go to the cinema pretty much every night. And I'll go and I'll watch anything, and I'll try and catch those neglected films or those films that maybe, you know, maybe get good reviews, but they're very difficult to get hold of. When the Black Widows and the Avengers films of this world are showing everywhere, and people come with their whole families and they're, you know, it's a big event for them. It's interesting that I'm the one sitting there thinking, oh, you know, I was in the same auditorium yesterday watching something else and I felt completely in my comfort zone, but I don't tonight. And I think that might be part of the problem, that there's a certain pressure and there's, and, you know, I will go the extra mile to watch a film that other people haven't even heard of. So why then, conversely, should I be going the extra mile to watch a film that other people, then it's other people's territory? It's like going to a party where everybody's in fancy dress and everybody has, you know, everybody knows everybody else there, and you feel like you're the interloper. And you might go to parties all the time, but you haven't been to this party and you don't know this particular group of people. So I have to be respectful to them, but at the same time, I it would be fake, you know, if I was trying to write a positive review. And I'm very honest in the reviews that I simply don't entirely get those films, and I wish that, you know, that they'd been taken in another direction. Because actually, The Black Widow is Kate Shortland, who's an Australian director, isn't she?
She is, and I went the other day, and there were families there, and they were enjoying it. And she's been interviewed a lot this week because it's the opening week of Black Widow on Australian radio. I've heard several interviews. Very interesting, giving her perspective and why she came to a big-budget Marvel universe from rather smaller-budget films.
Yeah.
By the way, with the Avengers and the Marvel universe, I really don't like the Avengers films in the sense that with the earlier compendiums, it looked as if they got all the superheroes, got them in line and said, go and have a battle. It's your turn. Good, finish. Now it's your turn. Go, finish. Next one, next one, next one. The last one I found more satisfying because it tended to integrate the stories more than one fight after another.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point, actually, because maybe that's the problem. Maybe I was looking at it through the wrong lens, because there was that sort of shocking scene in Black Widow where you discover that, you know, women have had their fertility removed, and you know, and the questions that raises about the role of women, and, you know, Ray Winstone's character, who's this, you know, horrible sort of, you know, a Nazi type figure. But what I find interesting is then there's a big sort of fetish around, you know, martial arts and watching it, and then another fight scene, and I was watching it thinking, you know, in another movie, you know, this would be really upsetting to watch, and I felt really quite appalled at this particular scene between Scarlett Johansson and Florence Pugh. And then it's back to the fighting. And part of me just thought, no, this isn't the way I want it to go. But maybe that just says more about me than it does about the film.
Well, in a sense, that's a good thing. Mm. I don't mind being, well, the bad thing they say is you like everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not true. But in a sense, that is, I'm glad to hear that about me, that I'm not known then to be automatically hostile, that there is a kind of a welcoming to the cinema rather than suspicion, or, as when I started reviewing, I thought a lot of puritanical attitudes. Why should you be spending such time seeing and writing? And the excuse was that when I was at school, I used to choose the films at boarding school and help the priest screen them. Yeah. So it was kind of generally known, yeah, he's to do with films. But still, what was a priest doing reviewing films? I'd have to say 40 years later, 30 years later, we had of our Australian religious order a meeting, and some of those who were hostile were actually pleased that I got elected to that international job. Mm-hmm. So, Chris, if you live long enough, good things happen.
Yeah. Well, as we start to wrap up, that you've actually given me a perfect seg into my next question, which is whether you have fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young, and whether this is what you imagined that you'd be doing. Because it sounds as though you mentioned that somebody referred to you as a completist, but actually what you've done is continued, you know, to develop and to hone the skills that you were clearly working on in from very young age in childhood. But is, you know, are those Were there other dreams that you had? Is this what you ever, would your teenage self have ever imagined that you'd be doing what you're doing now?
No, it's quite beyond, as you would imagine, I would say. I wrote reviews in English classes at school, so that was in mind. When I joined the religious order and the novitiate, the expectation was you wouldn't see films for the next 7 years, and I gave away a lot of my books and things like that. But funnily enough, whatever the providence, that very year they changed in the student house, and a relative of one of the students then brought out 16 millimeter prints. So in fact, I've never gone beyond 14 months without seeing a film. And we were very proper, and we said we wouldn't go. And the superior came out and said, "What's this I hear about you not going to the film? You will go." 30 years later, I heard him say, "I made him go to the films, and now he sees 500 a year. What have I done?" Yeah. So it actually developed. I was able to go to the university in Canberra. That wasn't what I was expecting. And then I was sent to Rome as a student. We had television, which we didn't have in Australia at the time. We had Thursdays at next to the Holy Office, of all things. There were screenings for clergy, and we were able to go every week. So whatever the providence, there was always the opportunity to see the films. And when I came home and a friend of mine was editing our magazine, I said, "What about a film review?" And we did. And then I wasn't expecting the international thing at all, and it happened. So it's, as I say, it's beyond.
Yeah. And what really comes out so strongly is the extent to which you're not simply doing what a lot of like pop stars do when they, you know, they reform and they just deliver all their old hits, their classics that people want to listen to. What you're doing is reviewing new films, that you're still doing the same thing, that you're not simply, you know, you could easily have said, "This is the canon, this is what I'm working with, and I'm not going to step beyond that." You could easily, in later years, have just sort of gone back to all those films that maybe you reviewed in the past. And, you know, you mentioned the 101 movies that you if you like, your desert island movies. And that would have been very laudable. You know, you could almost say, I've reached a certain point, and this is, you know, your own personal canon is closed. But no, the excitement that's generated from a whole range of films from different countries, from different perspectives, I think is phenomenal. But it also sounds as though your appetite, your eagerness, your drive has never been diminished.
That's true. And you reminded me, a lot of people who couldn't and wouldn't want to review or see so many films, and you can tell when they say, ask the question, "Aren't you sick of it?" Yeah. And my answer is, not yet.
Yeah. Well, I've got one more question to ask you. Would you consider yourself, Peter, to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I love looking back. I love living in the past. I cherish, you might have guessed that from how I've talked, that I can go back to many eras and be at home there and relish and enjoy and be thankful for what happened. But here I am. When this lockdown, when we're doing this interview, is over, one of the films that is on my list to see is called Gunpowder Milkshake. Now, I'm not sure that everybody will be rushing off to see Gunpowder Milkshake. I won't rush, but I will see it. And who knows? There's always something more. I like reading the IMDb each day, the news. Oh, this is coming. They're making this, they're making that, they're doing this. It's all in the future as well. Yes, definitely looking forward.
Do you know, Peter, I think when I, in a few decades' time, if somebody is interviewing me, I kind of feel that the conversation that I'm having with you is a conversation that somebody else will be having with me. It sounds as though we have a very similar sort of outlook and sense of work ethic and a passion for what we do. It has been awesome to catch up with you. Thank you so much, Peter, for doing this interview with me.
Chris, I think they are going to interview you in that vein in the future. So thank you very much for the invitation to have this conversation with you.